It is my pleasure to introduce Mike Quickenborn, who is a tenured philosophy instructor at Everett Community College in Anacortes. I'm saying that correct?
I live in Anacortes, in the college in Everett.
Being from the Midwest, I'm a little like Chuck, right? I'm never quite sure that I get my Washington or, now I'm going to say the state wrong, Oregon.
Oregon.
It's hopeless. The O state that starts with O that's next to Washington. I get some of the towns wrong. So, thank you, Mike. And his topic today is on, is there any winning the battle for truth? So, we'll let you answer it again. You answered it yesterday, right?
It's more about asking the question than answering it.
Yeah. So, and we're going to leave that open. It gets really hot in here, so you guys just kind of figure out what temperature you want it at. So, thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And yeah, again, thanks for your patience. Made me feel very much like I was back teaching, waiting for the first class to get out so I can get in and get going here. So, just want to let you know here, just very briefly, I've been teaching a class called Philosophy in the Cinema since 2000 at Everett Community College. And so this week, yesterday, and today, and then again on Friday, kind of doing a very condensed version of that class and showing some clips from some of the films that I show in their entirety in that class here, and then sort of interspersing the clips with comments and so forth. Couple things that I just want to make sure I remember to say. Certainly, you know, we're already getting a late start. And dinner is on the horizon, and I heard the ice cream's back. So, you know, at some point, feel free to, you can leave. You don't have to wait till the end of this. Also, at any point, feel free to just, you know, offer questions or comments. You don't need to feel like you need to wait till I'm done with this, because I really prefer kind of interaction, and I'll try and encourage that here in just a moment. Let's see, I also wanted to mention then, tomorrow I'm doing something a little bit different at 4 o'clock, right back here. Because I'm currently a member of the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau, and so I've been traveling around the state for actually the last 2.5 years. Tomorrow I'm going to give my current presentation, which is called The Good Game, on the moral value of sports. So it's not focused on film, it's on sports and ethics and so forth. Though I will show one clip from a film I showed a couple clips from yesterday, Waking Life, but it's mostly on sports. And so anyway, if you're interested, feel free to come back for that. Today, though, I guess the overall topic is truth, and to help us think about that, I'll be showing some clips from two films. One is called The Battle of Algiers from 1965, and then a film called Adaptation from 2002, so, you know, quite a gap there, but anyway, I think they'll both offer some interesting things to think about with regard to the topic. So, I think I've primed the pump too much already, but as a philosopher, when I go out and I talk to people, general audiences, we should say, I always like to ask, well, you know, what do you think philosophers are about? What do you think we're interested in? What do you think our goal is?
Tenure.
See? Yeah. Well, I have tenure, so that's in the past now for me. So now that I have tenure, what is it?
Teaching people to think.
Teaching people to think. Okay, absolutely, yeah.
Asking the right questions.
Asking the right questions, good. Mm-hmm. And teaching people to think, asking the right questions towards, you know, hopefully getting at the truth, right? And you got right to the truth, which is that, you know, it's all about tenure. But so, priming the pump, I think that, you know, hopefully in the end, you know, philosophers have this interest in truth. And I probably don't have to convince you that the topic of truth is an important one. So I'll make a connection here with something that will be familiar with Holdenites, the Gospel of John, and where Jesus states in chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Right? So well-known to Christians and non-Christians alike, I think. So we'll kind of hear that. But then I actually want to take a little detour here from that to something completely different, we might say, or as they might say in Monty Python. I want to take a detour to the Fountain of Youth. Okay, I'm getting older. It's on my mind a lot these days, the Fountain of Youth. And so the Fountain of Youth, of course, is a legendary spring that reputedly restores the youth of anyone who drinks of its waters. And so I just looked this up online, of course, before I came to the village, because that's really hard to do here. Here's a passage from NationalGeographic.com. "Alexander the Great, who conquered most of the known world before he died around 323 BC, may have been looking for a river that healed the ravages of age. During the 12th century AD, a king known to Europeans as Prester John supposedly ruled a land that had a river of gold and a fountain of youth. But the name linked most closely to the search for the fountain of youth is 16th century Spanish explorer Juan Ponce de Leon, who allegedly thought it would be found in Florida. And apparently, I haven't been there or seen this, but there's a cheesy tourist attraction featuring a fountain of youth in Augustine, Florida. Has anybody been there?
Okay, well,
I think it's kind of a tourist trap, is my understanding. So to date, no legitimate fountain of youth has ever been found, right? But for, what, thousands of years, people were trying to find a fountain of youth. Okay, so there's another question. Given the over 2,000 years of human failure to find such a fountain, how many of you think we should continue the search for the fountain of youth? Nobody. Yes, good. Right? So we shouldn't continue to look for the fountain of youth. And my first point here, and kind of weave this in throughout today, but I think perhaps we ought to have the same attitude toward truth. Or at least philosophers ought to have that same attitude. For thousands of years, philosophers have been looking for the ideal definition of what truth is all about, and we have failed to find it, I have to tell you. But to back up again, you probably weren't expecting to hear about the Fountain of Youth today, but about the same time Alexander the Great was searching for the fountain, the philosopher Plato speculated about a similarly fantastical place, which he called the World of Forms, and I talked a little bit about this in yesterday's presentation, because Plato said that there's this world of forms that's not perceivable by the senses, and basically what they are it's an ethereal realm of concepts, we might say. And the forms are, we might say, if you take a flower, as an example I used yesterday, so I apologize to those of you who were here yesterday. But if you think of a physical flower, Plato said actually, through something called the Allegory of the Cave, that the physical flower is not truly real. It's sort of a shadow of what's truly real, and what's truly real is the form of a flower. And the form of a flower is whatever it is that all flowers would have in common. I don't know what that is. It gives me a headache just to try and think about that. But that's what the form of a flower would be. And for Plato, this was what was truly real. Okay. Now, if you kind of just for a moment think about what would it take to figure out what is it that all flowers have in common, or another example I use is a chair, right? You think about, well, what do all chairs, every single thing that deserves the name of a chair, have in common? It's a challenge. It really requires you to sort of abstract from each, you know, physical example to come up with this general concept. It involves or requires the use of reason. And so what Plato said is that the people who are most in touch with reality are those who are best at using their ability to reason. And of course, as it happens, right, that happens to be philosophers, right? And so he's the philosopher who argued that, you know, society ought to be run by philosopher kings. It's always funny to me that, you know, when philosophers think about the best way to run society, it's philosophers that end up at the top. So I don't know why that is. So having said that, at least Plato would say, if you're looking for truth, you've come to the right place because, you know, I've been trained in philosophy. Well, why is Plato important for today's lecture? Because just as the Fountain of Youth had a long-lasting grip on the imagination of explorers around the world, the desire to find the truth behind what seems to be a world of illusion has had a long-lasting grip on the imagination of philosophers. This has been a defining pursuit in philosophy, and you can get a sense of the impact of Plato on subsequent philosophers in the following statement from the early 20th century British philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. And he said that, quote, "The safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato," right? And so when I hear that, I'm not a fan of Plato, actually, and it's pretty depressing, right? It's like Plato, right, we're talking about 2,400 years ago, approximately, and it's all been just footnotes to that for thousands of years. So you would think we could do something different. Maybe the postmodernists are doing that. We'll look at that as we proceed here. So, kind of reflecting on what are philosophers about. Well, I would say that my job as an instructor, and perhaps especially as a philosophy instructor, might be said to enlighten people as to the truth, right? The truth is out there, as the X-Files and philosophers have taught us. And by using our reason, supposedly, we can find it. At least this is the tradition in philosophy. Let me give you another philosopher here. I know I'm name-dropping a lot of people here, but at any rate. The late 20th century American philosopher Richard Rorty wrote in his essay, The Priority of Democracy to Philosophy, quote, the philosophical tradition has accustomed us to the idea that anybody who is willing to listen to reason, to hear out all the arguments, can be brought around to the truth. And this is, in fact, how philosophy tends to sell itself, as we heard, right? I mean, it's like, what is philosophy good for? It's good for getting people to be able to reason, and then eventually, hopefully, they'll come around to the truth. But I think an interesting question is, what if that were false advertising? I mean, it sounds really good. We're selling truth. Who doesn't want the truth? But what if that's false advertising? In other words, what if we had no way to know if we could access the real world, quote unquote, if such there be? The history of philosophy is replete with attempts to define truth conditions, okay, to get at reality or truth. So as I just said, for Plato, the true corresponded to unchanging, eternal, and necessarily like non-physical or non-material forms in this ethereal realm that, again, is only accessible to those of superior intellect. For other philosophers, truth has meant correspondence with reality, quote unquote. So just as a quick example of that, if you have a statement, it is raining in Anacortes, okay? What would make that statement true is that if we were to be in Anacortes right now, and you should visit, it would be raining, okay? That's what would make that true. If we were there, we look up, the rain's coming down, okay, that's what makes this statement true. That statement corresponds to the real world. For other philosophers, truth has meant coherence within a web of other claims. So that what makes a statement, it is raining in Anacortes, true, is that, in this case, if we were to look up on the weather radar, right, on the internet, and you see the green blob above Anacortes, and then maybe we call somebody in Anacortes, say, hey, is it raining there? And they say, yes, it is, right? All of the information we might want to gather about the rain in Anacortes would not contradict the claim, it is raining in Anacortes. Okay, so that's another way to think of the truth. Now, without going into all the details, unsurprisingly, there is no philosophical consensus on what constitutes the correct definition of truth. You will find thinkers who endorse each of these views, as well as many others. And I'll just share with you here, in 2013, there was a survey of, elite philosophers, so I was not included. But we're talking about philosophers at elite, you know, universities around the country in 2013. And in that survey, 42.7% agreed with the correspondence theory, right? That the statement it's raining in Anacortes is true if you were there and you see it's raining. 26.4% of philosophers interviewed or surveyed said they agreed with the coherence theory, that the claim is true if it fits or doesn't contradict a bunch of other claims. Mm-hmm. And 30.8% fit into neither camp, right? So you got quite almost a third, you know, for each group. So again, it's not surprising perhaps, but philosophers don't tend to agree on much. I've looked at that whole survey, and because I was looking for, what do philosophers tend to agree on? Is there anything that they tend to agree on? And you might be interested to know that the claim that garnered the most agreement amongst all philosophers, it wasn't by any stretch unanimous, but the claim that garnered the most agreement, this claim got more agreement than the claim that the world exists, right? There was more debate about the claim that the world exists than this claim. So what most philosophers, more than any other claim, agreed with was the claim that God doesn't exist. Okay, so just, you should know that. Okay. I wasn't among them. I wasn't surveyed, so it doesn't matter. Okay. Anyway, so I talked about three groups of philosophers, the correspondence theory group, the coherence theory group, and then other. Postmodernists, right? So today we're going to talk about postmodernism. Postmodernists are among these other philosophers. So postmodernism, there's a variety of ways to understand postmodernism, and it's notoriously complex, but it can be seen as a philosophical perspective, it can be seen as an aesthetic perspective, but postmodernism, seen philosophically, challenges the idea that there is any such thing as truth. And again, my goal certainly here today is not to convince you to agree with this, but I hope to at least help you to understand it a little bit better. And I'll be doing that again by showing you, we're going to get the movies, right? It came from movies. By looking at clips from Battle of Algiers and, again, adaptation. Okay. I would recommend, though, a book as well. The author is Christopher Butler. His book is Postmodernism, A Very Short Introduction. By the way, I should mention I wrote some things over here because everybody has websites, so I have websites. This website here has a bibliography and filmography, a listing of a bunch of movies and books that have to do with film and philosophy. And you can download it for free, and it organizes them by philosophical theme, if you're interested. The Battle of Algiers is a foreign film, and I have an affinity for all kinds of film, including foreign film. And I teach a class on ethics in 21st century world cinema, so I have a website for that. And if you want to get a hold of me, this is my Twitter handle, I guess is what it's called. I can give you my email address as well, which is also very easy. It's mvq@comcast.net. But anyway, that's my Twitter handle. I'm not on Facebook, because Facebook is all about friends, but I'm all about followers, and that's what Twitter's all about. So, okay. I was talking about Christopher Butler. He wrote a book called Postmodernism, A Very Short Introduction. And he wrote there, just to give you a sense of this view, much postmodernist analysis is an attack on authority and reliability in philosophy, narrative, and the relationship of the arts to truth. And I think we're going to see that quote reflected in what we're going to view here today. And also, another quote from Butler's book, he observes that one of the central themes of postmodernism might be summarized as realism lost, and along with it, a reliable sense of past history. And I think that last bit of that comment will be especially illustrated here in The Battle of Algiers, the first film we're going to look at. So, The Battle of Algiers from 1965. Has anybody seen that film? I'm always curious. Okay, two of you. Yeah, it's an outstanding film. There's a Criterion Collection, if you've heard of them. A Criterion Collection DVD of it with, like, you know, it's like three discs, tons of great stuff. I highly recommend it. But as we'll see here, the Battle of Algiers appears to be a reconstruction of the events that took place in Algiers in the mid-1950s, which is when there was a struggle against colonialism, right? Algiers was a French colony, and the native Algerians were rising up against that. The Battle of Algiers was directed by an Italian, Guido Pontecorvo, with significant Algerian contributions. I think it's an especially interesting film to watch today, 50 years later plus, in light of the Arab Spring in 2011, when you had, again, another wave of revolution in that part of the world. It's a film, overall, that is about the events that led to the end of Algeria's status as a French colony. Okay. So, before I show you the clip, I keep like pushing it back, but before I show you the clip, so this is going to be a film that's depicting historical events. How do those films often begin? There's usually like a phrase or something that appears.
One of those big maps with an airplane, you know, flying across it.
That's a nice way to do it. I like that. Yeah. Sometimes you use words, yeah.
Sometimes they start at the end and then identify how they got to that predicament.
Okay. Sure. Lots of different, I guess, narrative approaches. But what I'm fishing for, obviously, is something like, you know, based on a true story, for example. Right? We're familiar with that one, based on a true story. And you've seen other examples of these kinds of phrases that sort of set up the whole film. And I'm kind of a fan of these, so if you have others to share with me after that, let me know, because I've written them down. So, for example, let me share some with you here. You know the film Fargo?
Yes.
Right, yeah, makes you laugh just hearing about it, right? This is the funny thing. It begins with, this is a true story. It's not, okay? It's, not. It's interesting because, 2 years ago, another film came out called Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, which was about a Japanese woman who found an old VHS copy of Fargo in like an underpass in Tokyo or something, and she read the first line, this is a true story, and wasn't in on the joke, because it's not. In fact, she travels to the snowy fields of, like, North Dakota and Minnesota to try and find the loot that they bury at one point in the film. I think she's going to find it. So, anyway. Here's another one I like. Preceding the film Bernie, a recent film, begins, what you're fixin' to see is a true story. All right, so there's a nice down-hominess there. What you're fixin' to see there. The Imitation Game, right? Many of you probably saw that one, fine film. Begins with based on a true story. So that's sort of the standard, I think, boilerplate almost. Based on a true story. But what's the difference between that and the following that begins the film True Story? There's a film called True Story. It begins with the phrase, based on actual events. Okay, so we have based on a true story, based on actual events. I kind of turned the truth meter down a little bit there, but that's not, that just might be me. Here's another one, the film Hysteria. It begins with, this story is based on true events, and then there's a pause, and then it reveals the word really. So you can ask me after the session about why. Look it up. Another recent film called American Hustle begins with a very refreshingly honest phrase. It begins with, some of this actually happened. Right? So, I appreciate that honesty. The second film we'll look at clips from here today is Adaptation. And it begins with, based on the book The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. Okay, which is interesting. Now, that doesn't say this is true or anything like that. It says it's based on this book, The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. In the first clip I'll show you from that film, so this is in a few minutes now, but the first clip you'll actually see very briefly the front cover of the book, and at the bottom of the book it'll say, The Orchid Thief and so forth, a true story of beauty and obsession. So it's almost like there's a secondary or indirect link to truth there when it begins with based on the book The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. I didn't get a chance to see if our library here has it, but it's a popular book, it might be there. Okay. So a lot of films begin with this kind of phrase. I was curious, what do you think they mean, or how do you take them when you see that?
It's somewhat true. Yeah. Sorry. It irritated me when Fargo did that because it wasn't true. I mean, no wonder this woman in Japan did that, because how are you supposed to know if it is or not?
All right. The Coen brothers are responsible for her. I mean, it was a fictional, by the way, that story of the person from Japan, that was a fictional story.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's somewhat true, I heard, yeah. You know, it's interesting, right? Because again, as I said, you know, sometimes it begins with based on a true story, and then sometimes it begins with based on actual events. And my skepticism meter or, you know, sensitivity goes up there. And I think, like I said, maybe I turned down the truth meter a little bit. But, you know, if you kind of think about that for a moment, how does that work? How can you turn down the truth meter a little bit? I mean, isn't something true or false? Is there room in between? I'm not sure. I guess the way I take those kinds of statements that begin a lot of these films, and Fargo is a good example of this, I personally don't take that as it's true or not. I see that as sort of a pill that the director wants you to consume before you watch the movie. Right, so they say this is a true story. Fargo does. Why? Because they want to provoke laughter or something. I don't think they want to manipulate people in faraway lands to come and dig up treasure. But I think they're sort of like pills they want you to take, so you have a particular attitude toward what you're about to see, rather than being able to make any sort of connection to the truth. So we can come back to that. But go ahead.
Well, I always go home after those movies, and they have something looking up what's really true in the movie and what isn't true.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and the soundtrack is often better in a movie based on the true story.
Okay. All right. And of course, at least in my life, real life doesn't have a soundtrack, you know, so there's another difference. But yeah. So I want to come back to that a little bit because, as I'm suggesting here, even though this is a fairly widespread practice in films to begin with these kinds of phrases, I just really have a lot of questions or concerns about it. So I might come back to that. But then to bring us back to the Battle of Algiers, it begins with, and you won't be able to see it here because I'm going to skip to a different scene, but this film begins with the following statement. This dramatic reenactment of the Battle of Algiers contains not one foot of newsreel or documentary film. So it's kind of an interesting phrase. It doesn't say based on a true story directly. It's sort of almost sort of pushing truth away a little bit. It doesn't contain any documentary footage. Doesn't contain any newsreel footage. Although it does say it's a dramatic reenactment of something that happened. So there's still maybe a tenuous connection with historical events there. But it also kind of holds truth at arm's length a little bit. So the Battle of Algiers, I would say, is a historical drama. Though the way it's been filmed is almost in a documentary style. Okay, so, having said all of that, the first scene I'm going to show you, finally, is going to take place during a general strike organized by the native Algerian resistance. Well, I'm going to use the word resistance, and then I'm going to say slash terrorist force, because whether you see them as the resistance or terrorists depends, I guess, on how you see the whole conflict here. But it's a strike organized by the native Algerians known as the FLN. That was their organizational acronym. And their hope in having this strike, so they weren't going to go to work in Algiers, and of course they really formed the backbone of the economy there in Algiers. Their hope was to get the United Nations to pay attention to their cause and to goad the French into responding harshly. In other words, they wanted the French to say, no, you have to go to work and have this crackdown, which would then be televised or filmed, and the world would see how the French are oppressing them. And they hoped that the French would respond harshly and that it would then generate sympathy for their cause. The idea was, without the native Algerians working, the Algerian economy would come to a halt, harming the interests of the French colonizers. Okay? So the very purpose of the strike was to manipulate public opinion and create a truth, quote-unquote, for the United Nations that the Algerians were being oppressed. The French, on the other hand, saw Algeria as an integral part of France. It was territory that had been under French control for 130 years at one point in the film. I don't think in this clip they make reference to that, but it's, you know, it was a long time colony, and so the French at the time saw this as an integral part of France. So, before I screen the clip, you might be wondering who the main protagonists in the film are, but what's interesting, one of the things that's interesting about the film is that this film is remarkably short on characters, and in fact there isn't the main protagonist. There isn't like the hero of the film who eventually liberates Algeria, something like that. Other than, we might say, the Algerian people as a whole. Now, on the French side of the conflict, the French side is embodied very powerfully in the only professional actor in the film, Jean Martin, and he portrays Lieutenant Colonel Mathieu. And so the scene we're about to see, finally, shows French reporters asking Colonel Mathieu what he thinks of the war he's waging on behalf of the French people. So I have to kind of do things with DVDs.
So the battle was between
the Algerian resistance force and the French army.
Okay. Can you give just a real brief definition of what your definition of postmodernism?
Postmodernism. Let's see. I mean, I think I'll just go back to Butler's quotes, okay? Because I think they encapsulate that really nicely. So two things. Postmodernism is an attack on authority and reliability, okay, in philosophy, narrative, and the relationship of arts to the truth, right? So, for example, the arts like film, right? When a film says, we're going to depict, you know, a historical event, postmodernism says, I don't think so. And we're going to see that reflected in adaptation as well in the other clips. As Butler writes later, you can see postmodernism as sort of saying, we should get rid of the idea of realism. We should get rid of the idea that there is an objective truth that can be accessed by people everywhere, regardless of their circumstances. So I'm adding a little bit of my own thought there. But, okay? Okay.
On ne signale aucun incident sérieux. Il y a calme absolu dans les quartiers du port. Puis-je vous poser quelques questions? Oui, bien sûr. Je vais vous le faire. Au moins savoir ce qui se passe.
Absolument rien. On fait la prévision.
Allez vous rendre compte par vous-même. J'ai mis tous les moyens à votre disposition. Allez faire un tour et vous verrez ce qui se passe.
En tout cas, la grève semble avoir réussi.
Non. Elle a manqué son objectif principal.
L'insurrection?
L'insurrection.
Mais ce n'est pas une grève insurrectionnelle.
Et vous croyez aux affirmations du FLN?
Elles semblent plausibles cette fois-ci. Une grève générale est un bon argument pour le FLN.
J'aurais dû aller moins à peine, cher monsieur. Comment peut-elle juger de l'importance d'une grève? Pour le FLN, il serait plus facile de se faire entendre avec les bombes. C'est ce que je ferai à leur place.
Qu'est-ce qu'une insurrection armée pourrait impliquer en ce moment?
C'est implique toute insurrection armée. C'est un moment inévitable de la guerre révolutionnaire. Après une première phase de terrorisme, on passe à l'insurrection armée. C'est ainsi que de la guérilla, on passe à la vraie guerre.
Viennent bien fous.
Précisément. En Indochine, ce sont eux qui ont vaincu.
Et ici?
Cela dépend de vous.
De nous? Auriez-vous l'intention de vous faire recruter, mon colonel?
Dieu m'en garde. Vous devez seulement écrire et, si possible, bien écrire. Des guerriers, il y en a plus qu'il n'en faut.
Qu'est-ce qui manque alors?
Une volonté politique qui parfois existe, parfois non. Parfois elle est insuffisante, selon les jours. Hier, que disait-on à Paris?
Rien. Un autre article de ça.
Qui peut me dire pourquoi les Sartres naissent tous d'un même côté?
Alors, Sartre vous plaît, mon colonel?
Non. Mais il me plaît encore moins de l'avoir comme adversaire.
All right, so quick reference there to French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. I don't know, I think that scene is remarkably prescient. It's 1965, many, many decades ago, but clearly there's a recognition there of the power of the media and of language and the way that that can play a role in shaping reality. And in fact, the very film itself, I think, is an example of media shaping the way history is perceived. So this came out in 1965, about a decade more or less after the Algerian Revolution, we could say. And you know, this film might do more than anything else to shape how civilization, how humans understand what went on in the Algerian conflict. So Mathieu suggests that whether or not the French will succeed in Algeria depends on what? The media, right? He's not saying go sign up to grab a gun and go defend France's interests in Algeria, or he's not talking about we need to develop new weaponry or anything like that. He's talking about using the media to affect political opinion, and that's how the war will be won, right? And so that knowledge now, in putting that word in quotes, or the truth, unquote, is a tool. It's another weapon of war. And so, I have another scene here to show you, but after my students, we usually watch the whole film, and I always like to ask my students then, well, was this film true? Right? Do you think that question could make sense? You watch this film, depicting all the stuff that supposedly happened. Is it true? What would make you want to say, yeah, that was a true film, or no, that wasn't? And you talked about how you go home, right, for example, and look things up on the internet. And I actually have my students do that. I send them to the Wikipedia, right, which we all know is perfectly reliable.
Which side produced the film, though?
Right. So that's a great question, right? And so had a lot of financial backing from, well, Italy, which was not France, of course, and the Algerians themselves. And many of the people who were involved in the conflict are actors in this film. But if you watch the whole thing, and obviously we don't have time to do that, there are scenes in here that the most compelling scene for me in this film, and you've seen it, I think you said, is there's one scene where they show these young women preparing or getting bombs put into purses, and then they're dressing up to appear more French, I guess we could say, and then they're sending them out into a bar or a restaurant, a ticket office for the French airline, and then somewhere else that I'm forgetting. And the movie takes, 5 minutes, sort of just watching the women standing there as they set their bags down, making sure it's going to be okay, and it's on a timer. And then the film just pans around. You see everything that these women are seeing, which are these young French people, enjoying themselves and so forth, and children as well. And so, when you see a scene like that, you think, well, yeah, it was produced with Algerian money and backed by the Algerian force, but there's something about that scene that is certainly not, I guess, necessarily pro-Algerian forces, right? At the same time, they show scenes in the film where the French police are actually going and planting bombs, and in fact, in response to that attack with the bombs and the restaurants and so forth, they go and plant a bomb in the where the Algerians live, in the neighborhoods that they live. And so you see attacks on both sides. So you're left with, and this is one thing I think this film does very nicely, you're left with this idea of, well, is it true or not, right? You see kind of horrible things on both sides. And I guess what I would say is I don't know that there's any way to answer that question. I do the same thing. I look things up and say, well, what went on here? But I don't know if there's any way to answer that question. I think what is clear, though, is that this film, and probably any film, shapes how people feel about the events. So, let me show you another scene, though, that also, I think, reflects some postmodernist concerns. And this next scene will take place on day 6 of the general strike, so this strike is ongoing. And the French are becoming increasingly frustrated with the success of the strike. And the very beginning of the scene will show Algerian men streaming back into the Casbah. This is where the native Algerians lived in Algiers. They're going back to that area after being apprehended by the police for taking part in the strike. So in other words, they weren't working, the police went in and rounded them up and imprisoned them for a certain amount of time or held them. And now they're going back to their homes finally. And what you're going to see in the scene is the French military are addressing the populace of the Casbah, attempting to break the strike through what would now perhaps be called psychological warfare, right? So today it would be done with social media, but back in 1950s, they had a loudspeaker. And as these men are streaming back into the Casbah, a French military officer is saying, the strike is failing, and you'll see this, but the strike is failing and so forth. Go back to work. This is a waste of your lives and time and so forth.
Le bénévole, 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 le bénévole
What did you notice about that scene? Think about it. Thank you. I have things, but
propaganda is part of our lives, definitely right now.
Absolutely. Big time. Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting about this scene, of course, though, because I mean, we might say that there's propaganda on both sides, perhaps, but is that the people didn't respond to the French officer speaking, right? The adult French officer. They responded to the boy speaking Arabic. So that language, right, has a role to play here, a very important role to play, apparently. In determining, you know, whether or not there is success or there is failure. The French are attempting to persuade the Algerians to end the strike in French, but the words that are received as truth are the ones spoken in Arabic. Yeah. And so what postmodernism, one of the things it would also suggest, is that language itself helps shape the truth, quote-unquote, of the situation. In other words, truth is not language independent. Right? The people there, the Algerians, I should say, are going to think that, yes, the strike is going to be a success, I think, because they're hearing this in Arabic. Okay, so I have... Yeah, sorry.
I was just saying, it's not a very good message either, like, France is your motherland. Who's going to be persuaded by that if you're an Algerian?
Yeah, right.
And then they talk about Allah, and then they talk about God. I mean, this is a Muslim group. I would think, you know, the God part would not be their words.
Right, so, yeah, right. Again, just whether you call God or Allah, right, makes a difference in how you understand it, whether you receive it, and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. We see that in Christians and Muslims as an example. Great, thank you. So I have one more clip to show you, and then we're going to turn to adaptation. This is a very grim kind of film. Adaptation is a hilarious film, actually, so I will end on a higher note. But the Battle of Algiers ends in a way very unlike a typical Hollywood film. So about 10 minutes before the end of the film, there's a group of main characters, more or less, from the FLN, and one of their children are blown up after a standoff at the apartment building where they have a hiding spot, so the French actually blow them up. And they do this, I would say, after the FLN people try to blow up the French, right? So it's not like it's one-sided necessarily, but they're blown up. So you think, okay, these main characters who are pushing the revolution, they all die. Right? What's going to happen now? Well, the film continues. And it continues with the scene that we're about to see here. And I would say that the way that the FLN people are killed kind of put me in mind of the assassination of Osama bin Laden. And that also, I wanted to make a connection here. Film Comment magazine noted that this film, The Battle of Algiers, was screened at the Pentagon shortly after the beginning of the most recent war in Iraq, in order to give the military leaders a sense of the type of fighting that they might encounter in Baghdad. And for better or for worse, and in fact, this film from 1965 depicts waterboarding. And so you think about why would people get the idea that this is something that we should be doing? Maybe it comes from this film. I can't say for sure. So the film continues, though, after the FLN leaders are blown up, as if that was sort of a mere footnote to the story. And what happens is Lieutenant Mathieu is seen in the film announcing that the head of the FLN has been cut off, like the head of a snake being cut off. But what happens is that after 2 years of dormancy, the Algerians begin their protests once again, and this will set the scene for the final clip here that I'm going to show you, which is chapter 34.
Écoutez-moi. Retournez chez vous. Qu'est-ce que vous voulez? Discipline! Discipline! Discipline!
I just want to let you know that none of those people we just saw there, we haven't seen them at all before in this film. So it's not like they were like these characters that have been carried through. So it seems to suggest here that, you know, what won Algeria's independence was the Algerian people as a whole and not, you know, the individual efforts of these particular leaders. And again, to get back to postmodernism again, in postmodernism there's a de-emphasis on the individual with your, you know, unique claim to the truth, but more of an emphasis on the collective and what a group might see as, okay, this is how the world is, or that's how the world is. And again, I think you see that, I think, reflected in this film. So, other thoughts, though, to come about postmodernism with the film adaptation. But before I get there, was there anything else, questions or thoughts about Battle of Algiers? Yeah.
What makes this particular film so significant?
Yeah, well, several things. I mean, I think the time period, 1965, postmodernism was not really coming into vogue then. So I think some of these thoughts, some of the ideas that kind of formulated the film are sort of almost pre-postmodern, if we can coin that term. As you just saw, like the struggle, much of the struggle that is depicted in the film is in the 50s. They win their independence in 1962. The film comes out in 1965. That's a very short time period. And so you can see that this film is going to probably go a long way to shaping the world's consciousness of what the Algerian struggle was about. And of course, this is all taking place in the midst of anti-colonialism in other parts of the world, Vietnam, right? There's a reference to that in the first clip today. So I think it, you know, plays a role in Western society, European society, excuse me, in terms of how they thought about these kinds of struggles. Interestingly enough, again, the director Gio Pontecorvo, this is the only film he directed, which I think is a shame because I think it's a brilliant film. So, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, you get past the more, you know, vague idea or the philosophy about it. What is there an objective reality that has existed or persisted through time?
Yeah.
It's obviously the case that. Assuming there is that objective reality, things did happen in a particular way. In, you know, and but accessing what that is always relies on stories being told about that get relayed to you as a listener.
Yeah,
and so how you receive that depends on your predisposition in a sense, what your priors are, what you've heard before, what you believe, what community you're in, or what language it's in.
Yeah.
And that's all, you know, that's always been the case. And so, you know, you can certainly ask the question, is it possible to, you know, how can you as a person really, you know, perceive the truth outside of watching the Fair and Balanced News Network, right?
Right, absolutely.
You know, so there's always that, and you know, maybe this film is one idea of showing, you know, what those things are, but I would same thing. In any film, you know, the dialogue is, of course, rewritten. You know, nobody knows what people actually said.
Absolutely.
Unless it was actually recorded and put on Twitter or something that you actually see what you put down. Yeah. But other than that, it's always a case of you're interpreting all these things coming at you, and you're deciding what is truth, and it doesn't really matter. It's really what you take forward and go, you know, does that...
Yeah. I'm just going to first of all say thank you, because that's going to be perfect, like lead-in to adaptation. Okay, but here's the struggle. I think the film I just saw recently, Hidden Figures, about the African American women involved in the moon, the NASA, the moon program, the Apollo program, I should say. And so people take a film like that, right? And they this is based on a true story and so forth. I think that's, I didn't write it down because I think it was just based on a true story, something pedestrian like that. But, and people take that as, oh, this happened, you know? Isn't this whatever, great or terrible or whatever? This happened. But what you're describing is actually what happened. And the great thing about adaptation, which we'll look at here coming up next, is, and how many of you have seen adaptation? I should ask that. So just a few more of you, right? So most of you have. Is that this is a film, again, that I think also fits in to the postmodernist vein or way of thinking, because it lays bare exactly what you described, okay? So can I maybe just sort of put it off a little bit and come back to that point? Because I think adaptation really addresses or illustrates what you're talking about. Yeah.
I just wanted to say about Battle of Algiers. The first time I saw it was at a class I took.
Yeah.
Arabic literature and film.
Yeah.
And the teacher asked, which side do you think the film was on?
Yeah, I asked that same question.
And I said the Algerian side.
Uh-huh.
And she said, why do you think so?
Yeah.
And I said, because that's the side I was on, and I think the filmmaker took me there. But obviously not everybody would be on that side watching that movie.
Yeah, I really encourage everybody to see it, because I think, you know, that's a great question that your instructor asked, because as I was saying earlier, it leaves you kind of torn. I mean, the Algerians are doing terrible things. There's a scene where it shows some, we might say, you know, fundamentalist Muslims who are doing horrible things to, like, the town drunk. And so even Islam does not, you know, get portrayed in a healthy light. I'm not going to quite get to the clip yet, but thank you. So, I don't know.
The scene with the women and the bombs, of course, is horrifying.
What's that?
The scene with the women playing.
With the bombs, yeah.
It's horrifying, it is, too. Yeah.
But they have a reward because they get their freedom. So does that make it morally right?
Well, but see, this film is, you know, depicting events that happened in the past. So, I mean, they have to, I mean, in a sense, they have to depict it that way. Unless you're Quentin Tarantino, then you can do whatever you want. So, I don't know. I mean, I think, I understand. I think probably if you took a poll, more people would say that this film favors the Algerian side than the French. But I also wonder, kind of what, keeping in mind what you said, you know, our own anti-colonialist biases probably feed into that as well. Yeah. So, okay, so adaptation, we're going to get to here. This film is directed by Spike Jonze, and the screenwriter for this film was Charlie and Donald Kaufman. And they're kind of a famous, Spike and Charlie are a famous duo. They also did the film Being John Malkovich, which maybe more people have seen, a great film. I like to point out that Charlie Kaufman was nominated for Best Original Screenplay Academy Awards for Being John Malkovich. He didn't win. For adaptation, Charlie and his brother Donald Kaufman, they were the screenwriters for this movie, and it was based on, as I already alluded to, based on the book Orchid Thief. They were nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for the Academy Awards, and they didn't win. And I was very relieved when they didn't win, because had they won, I mean, it would have been particularly galling to me, because then Donald Kaufman would have an Academy Award, and he doesn't even exist. So Donald Kaufman is like a creature of this film. He's a figment of the Charlie Kaufman's imagination, a twin brother. Both Donald and Charlie Kaufman in this film, they both appear in this film, and they're portrayed by Nicolas Cage, by the way. So I kind of like to say that this is sort of the high watermark of Nicolas Cage's career, but I don't know. I could be wrong. I mean, didn't he do the Left Behind series? He was in that, I think. So anyway. Stop. Okay. Too many comments. Okay. The first thing that I've already might have picked up on this, the first thing that's odd about this film adaptation is that the screenwriter, Charlie Kaufman, is himself the main character in this film. Okay, so that's a neat trick, if you can pull it off. And this is ostensibly an adaptation, as I said earlier, of Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. And The Orchid Thief is a nonfiction work about orchids and the desire to possess them. So in the first clip, you're going to see, that I'm going to show you here in a second, you're going to see Nicolas Cage portraying Charlie Kaufman, who is meeting film executive Valerie Thomas to discuss having Charlie adapt The Orchid Thief into a screenplay. Any questions, I guess I should say, with that probably inadequate description?
There's a moment for time to stop sweating. I've got to stop sweating. Can't you see dripping down my forehead? Oh, she's looking at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald.
She thinks you're great.
Oh, wow. Thanks. That's nice to hear.
We all just loved the Malkovich script.
Thanks.
Such a unique voice. Boy, I'd love to find a portal into your brain.
Trust me, it's no fun.
So tell me your thoughts on this crazy little project of ours.
First, I think it's a great book.
La Roche is a fun character, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Orlean makes orchids so fascinating. Plus her musings on Florida and orchid poaching, Indians, it's great sprawling New Yorker stuff. And I want to remain true to that. You know, I want to let the movie exist rather than be artificially plot driven.
Great. I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Oh. I'm not sure I know what that means either. I just don't want to ruin it by making a Hollywood thing, you know, like an Orchid Heist movie or something, you know, or changing the orchids into poppies and turning into a movie about drug running, you know? Why can't there be a movie simply about flowers?
I guess we thought that maybe Susan, Orlean, and LaRoche could fall in love.
Okay,
and
but I'm saying it's like an only crime in sex, or guns, or car chases, you know, or characters, you know, learning profound life lessons, or growing, or coming to like each other, or overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end. You know, it's the book isn't like that, and life isn't like that. You know, it just isn't. And you know, I feel very strongly about this.
Okay. So, I have to admit, it took me a couple viewings to pick up on this, but as he's saying there, he doesn't want to turn Susan Orlean's book into, you know, having the car chases and all the typical Hollywood stuff. By the end of the film, so I forgot to mention, there is a statute of limitations, on spoiler alerts, so I'm not going to issue a spoiler alert. I'm just going to tell you that by the end of the film, every single thing he said he does not want to have happen in the film will happen. Car chases, drugs, the whole bit. Okay. So yeah, this is a very strange film. And I think one thing that, again, ties it into this postmodernist idea that really we have to be very skeptical of any attempt to say that, well, this is the truth, gets back to your comments, okay? So what this film reveals very clearly is the following. We have this chain, we might say, that gets displayed for us here in the film. We have the, quote, real world, right? By the way, I just put the word real in quotes there. Okay, don't try that at home. That's just for philosophers. Just kidding. And then we have a character by the name of John LaRoche and other characters describing what happened, the real events that happened, supposedly. They are telling what happened to the writer Susan Orlean. This is Meryl Streep right here. You can kind of see her. Meryl Streep portrays Susan Orlean in this movie. So you have the real world, you have John LaRoche and others telling Susan Orlean what happened, and then Susan Orlean, of course, is writing this down. And then you have Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, being turned into a screenplay by Charlie and Donald, if you like, Kaufman. And then you have that screenplay being turned into a film by Spike Jones, although, you know, any major Hollywood production is the result of many, many efforts. But you have, say, Spike Jones turning it into a film, and then finally, you all see the movie adaptation, right? And so just as you were saying, right, reality is way up here, and then there are all these filters, and it finally gets to us. And this film makes it so that you can't avoid seeing that, you know what, we really don't have any idea what happened. Right? When does the film cross over from what really happened to the whole the drug running and the car chases and all that? It's not going to be clear. And that approach to making a film, I think, is what I think firmly puts this in sort of a postmodern mindset. I encourage you all to see it. To go on from that, though, what would a film be about, or what could a film be about? Well, in the final clip here that I'm going to show you today, we're going to listen to Charlie Kaufman again, and he's going to be lamenting the fact that he's just realizing that he has become part of, and in fact become the heart of, the film he's attempting to create, or the screenplay he's attempting to create. I'll let you know that in this scene, you are going to see Donald Kaufman as well, also portrayed by Nicolas Cage, and I need to just give you some context here. Throughout the course of this film, while Charlie's working on his screenplay for The Orchid Thief, Donald is working on his own screenplay for a film that, called The Three, I think it's called The Three, and this film is your typical serial killer film, where you have a cop and then chasing a serial killer who has somebody held hostage, right? Kind of a typical thing. But the twist, as Donald explains at one point in the film, not in this scene, but or maybe it is in the scene. At any rate, he explains that the twist is that all three characters are the same person, multiple personalities. Of course, Charlie asks, how can you do that, right? And he says, Donald's response is trick photography. Which isn't going to work. At any rate, Donald is doing this sort of traditional Hollywood thing, And he's coming in to talk to Charlie about his screenplay, and then Charlie's kind of recognizing that he's written himself into his own screenplay. So, let me find chapter 16. Thank you.
I'm done. Can you show it to your agent? It's called the Three. Thanks. I also want to thank you for your idea. It was very helpful. I changed it a little. Now the killer cuts off body pieces and makes his victims eat them. It's kind of like Caroline has this great tattoo of a snake swallowing its own tail and Ouroboros. I don't know what that means. A snake, it's called Ouroboros. I don't think so. But anyway, it's cool for my killer to have this modus operandi because at the end, when he forces a woman who's really him to eat herself, he's also eating himself to death. I'm the same. I'm Ouroboros. I don't know what that word means. I've written myself into my screenplay. That's kind of weird, huh? It's self-indulgent. It's narcissistic. It's solipsistic. It's pathetic. I'm pathetic. I'm fat. I'm pathetic. I'm sure you have good reasons, Charles. You're an artist. The reason is because I'm too timid to speak to the woman who wrote the book. Because I'm pathetic. Because I have no idea how to write. Because I can't make flowers fascinating. Because I suck. Am I in the script? I'm going to New York. I'll meet her. That's it. That's all I have to do. Don't.
So he realizes then that. He's written himself into his own script. It's just to the right there. Thank you. And at this point, he thinks the solution. He's been struggling throughout the whole film to try and adapt this book into a screenplay. He thinks the solution is going to be, well, I'll go talk to Susan Orlean, get to the source directly, and that will somehow, you know, I guess, reveal the truth of what he should write. After this scene, he does actually go to New York. Donald goes with him. Charlie does not meet Meryl Streep / Susan Orlean. He sends Donald to do it in his stead. And it doesn't go well, and it doesn't solve anything, because as we know, and as we've known from the very beginning, Charlie remains the focus of the film. And so what this suggests, I think, is that I think a key message here, a core message of the film, is that maybe all we can really talk about is ourselves. Right? We might try and talk about these other experiences, but essentially this film is only about Charlie Kaufman. And he can't get outside of that. He can't get outside of his own mind. And we've seen that on display throughout the whole film. And I think that is, again, to tie this back into postmodernism, that's something that postmodernism wants to suggest, that challenge this idea of reality that's intersubjective, that there is an objective truth that multiple people can recognize and agree to, and say that, no, it's really kind of down to our own biases and our own perspectives, as you were talking about earlier, our own perspectives that we bring to matters, and that to look for something that can be shared as a shared truth between people doesn't exist. So that's kind of the postmodernist look. I did hear the bell toll, but I don't think it is tolling for me. It's tolling for something else. Hopefully not. So maybe I'll pause here. I have some other things I can say. Thoughts, questions, criticisms, pushing back against this idea.
What is that ant that's crawling across the screen?
I need to flip that down. It's not too distracting. Remember, Charlie said, I don't want to do car chases. You didn't have to do that, Josh, but thank you. Car chases and drugs and so forth, right? So this movie is about, the book was about orchids. And in the film, then they become a source of some sort of drug. And so Meryl Streep's character, Susan Orlean, in the film, I don't know if this happened in reality. Don't even feel like talking about reality. She takes this drug, and it's causing a hallucination that there are ants crawling all over. Yes. One of Meryl Streep's many fine performances here, by the way.
Always good with her.
Yeah. What about science, right?
I was just kind of curious, the relationship between philosophy and science. Because science came out of natural philosophers, right? And so you have this idea that, starting with this idea that we can find the truth just by kind of thinking about it, rationalizing it, and then it's sort of a group sort of evolved from that and said, okay, wait a minute, there's the way to find objective truth about some things is to be able to to actually, you know, do experiments or do some, make some kind of a hypothesis and see if you can predict and go from there.
Gather evidence.
And, well, you know, gather evidence and some from that comes from the idea that you can't prove, there is no proof. All you can really do is say something isn't true because you've refuted it with some other type of a test. Say, well, that can't be true because this is the case.
Right.
And in some case, when we're looking at things that happen, we sort of have to do that as people. We're sort of trained to do that. We keep things in our mind until the voice is coming from other directions screaming, no, that's not what really happened. Get loud enough, and then we might finally change our minds and think, wait a minute, I've been wrong all this time.
Right.
This is actually what happened. The English were right in the American Revolution, or something
right.
like that, you
right.
know, that's completely contrary to what you thought. But I guess you can't find truth outside of the context of everything else. You can't think about, is this movie true or not, without a lot of other things to rely on. And
okay. I mean, I think the worry there is the worry that we saw in the first clip about Mathieu saying the media has to, you know, create the political will and the idea that we can succeed and so forth. And the worry there is that people will just get bullied or pushed by the media to believing certain things. And I think the scientist's response or the historian's response is, no, look for the evidence, and that should direct, you know, your thoughts as to what's true or what's not. I will kind of touch on science a little bit in Friday's session, but I mean... I've given this presentation before and along these lines to my college students, and it's, you know, obviously a mixed audience there, some of whom are probably going to want to be scientists, and maybe some of you are scientists. And so I always wonder, you know, about postmodernism and how a scientist might take it. So just real quick here, and I know we're running a little shorter on time, or it's 4:00, but I'll wrap this up fairly quickly here. In the middle of the 20th century, there's a movement called logical positivism. A British philosopher by the name of A.J. Ayer wrote a book called Language, Truth, and Logic, and this sort of encapsulates this idea of logical positivism. And for some, this is sort of the epitome of the scientific outlook. I'm not saying it should be, but for some it is. And their view was that if, in order to say that a statement is meaningful, it has to be able to be empirically verifiable. So, for example, you know, to say that... the moon is, however, was it 93 million miles away from the Earth or something like this? If that statement is going to have meaning, there has to be some empirical way to test for that. And I think today we use lasers and bounce lasers off the moon or whatever it might be. To say that, you know, this water bottle is 10 ounces, for that to be a meaningful statement, you have to be able to, you know, put it on a scale and look, it says 10 ounces, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's only 5 ounces or whatever it might be. So I think for many people who are scientifically inclined, that statement has a lot of force to it. There is truth. If you can empirically verify it, if you can gather evidence and accumulate it, then a statement, once it gets a sufficient amount of evidence in its favor, we can say is true. Does this make sense, what I'm saying here? I mean, I'm not saying you agree with it, but I mean...
But the problem is you really can't research everything.
Okay.
You know?
You can't.
And what's true in research may not always be accurate either. You know, I mean, it depends
right.
on what, how the research was done.
Okay, so the positivists would say, for example, life on Mars, right? This is a question that's open right now. We send probes up and things, right? So is there life on Mars? Is that true or false? The positivists would say, that statement that there is life on Mars, we don't know right now if it's true or false, but it's the kind of statement that could be verified or not, because we can send the probe up and it can study things and find out. So they would make room for statements that have yet to be verified. But what they want to do is they want to avoid saying that there are meaningful statements that are just statements that can't have any evidence accumulated for them. Okay. So the positivists were, for example, anti-religious belief, for example, right? Because, you know, statements about God can't be empirically verified. They can maybe be verified in other ways, but not empirically, not using perceptual apparatus or scientific apparatus. And so they want to say that you can make statements like that. They might make you feel good, but they're not true or false. Where they got in a little bit more trouble was when they said, what they said was about moral claims, right? Murder is wrong. Can you empirically verify that murder is wrong? You can't, right? I mean, unfortunately, we can go to YouTube and we can find videos of horrific things, you know, right? And you can look at that video and you can, you know, watch however long it is, but there's no meter you can bring to that and say, oh, look at this, the wrongness is off the charts here, right? So there is no way to empirically verify murder is wrong. And so what the positivists say is, well, okay, we can live with that. Statements like murder is wrong, those are statements that make you feel good. They're like music. This piece of music makes me feel good. It's not true or false. It just makes me feel good. So they try and make those kind of accommodations so that they can say, they can continue to say, really the criterion of truth is, can we empirically verify it? The problem is, and just looking at the time here, I'll say two more things. The problem is, their belief that the only meaningful statements are those that can be empirically verified, that statement, that's the core of their belief. That statement, can it be empirically verified? And then you say, oops, right? It can't. Their very core statement that statements are meaningful only if they can be empirically verified cannot itself be empirically verified. Therefore, apparently, it's just meaningless. It's always bad when your own position refutes itself, I guess. It's sort of a philosophical standard.
When you apply this to real life,
right.
How do you teach children what's truth and what's not?
Right.
That's a very difficult thing to do.
You're telling me, right? 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. So.
You know, and they're hit it. They're bombarded all the time, more so than we ever were when we were young.
Yeah. Know? Right. No kidding. Right. All the different influences and so forth. Absolutely. So, tell me what. No, I don't know that I have the answer. But here's kind of. And I'll end with this positive note, right? Because the postmodernist viewpoint is very negative, right? It's saying, well, we don't know what's true. We can't say that there is any reality and so forth, as we were saying earlier. I would leave us with this, and this is kind of personally where I end up. I'm more in line with, did I mention Richard Rorty earlier? He's a pragmatist, some people might call him a postmodernist, but a pragmatist. And I would talk to you about the pragmatist approach, which is an American philosophical tradition from the earlier part of the 20th century, probably about people like William James, John Dewey, and others. And basically they say the criterion of truth should be whether or not a claim is useful or not. Okay, and to go back to your question then, right? So we want to teach children, don't lie, right? You shouldn't lie. It's wrong to tell a lie. But we all know that with the exception of a certain philosopher from Prussia by the name of Immanuel Kant, there are circumstances when we should lie, when it is the right thing to do to lie, right? And so, for example, if you are living in Nazi Germany and you are hiding Jews in your basement and the Nazis knock on the door and say, we're searching for Jews, are you aware of anybody in this area? You should say, no, I'm not, right? Definitely you should lie in that circumstance. So there are these circumstances. So there are these times when you want to tell children don't lie, but in the end you have to kind of go deeper than that, and you have to say what's going to be most useful to produce, you might say, the most flourishing, is the most beneficial belief for human beings. That for me is the criterion of truth that I would pursue. But I'm just saying that in a couple of words here. But that's kind of where I would.
If you open up usefulness, then you've got all kinds of craziness for political expediency.
Right.
And it's so.
Yeah.
The doubters have a free ride. And
We always have to be open to dialoguing them. That's the key here, right? So if you're going to shut yourself off from other viewpoints, then you're going to run into those kinds of dangers. And so there always has to be this pursuit of an open dialogue with people who disagree with you. And then hopefully, eventually, you will arrive at what's called a reflective equilibrium, right? You've heard both sides, and you kind of settle on a position. But you're absolutely right. And that's a danger here of that view, for sure. I would just say there's also a danger of saying, I have the truth, it's the objective truth, and everybody should believe it, right? We can recognize that as well.
Well, that goes back to the second clip that you did in the first part, which is language and it's not only what's said, it's what you hear.
Yeah.
And you can say the same things to two different crowds. And I mean, I think in my hometown, right, you know, people are going to hear a lot, something a whole lot different than what I'm going to hear.
Absolutely, right? So as we heard earlier, when people are referring to God as Allah, right, it's like suddenly it's a very foreign concept. But it's like, wait a minute, you know, this is Abrahamic tradition. We should be able to talk to these people, right? And yet, just the use of that one word can put people off and prevent dialogue, which is a problem. Yeah. Thanks for your comments and questions, and thank you. Yeah.